Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before we begin today's exposition, if you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of Paul's first epistle to Timothy, one of the pastoral epistles where the apostle directs his protege about life in the church of the living God and how to order it. Timothy is pastoring in Asia Minor. He's in the church at Ephesus that Paul founded, and Paul has him there to correct certain disorders that are afoot in that church, especially in the form of some false teaching. Now in chapter 3, he gives us some qualifications for overseers and deacons. And let me say that overseers are elders. Elders are overseers, and overseers / elders are shepherds. Those are three terms. They all look at the same office from different points of view. In chapter 3, verse 1, the apostle says, "Here is a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer in the church, he means, desires a noble task." It's a noble work. It's a God-pleasing work. "Now, the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach," verse 3, "not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him, and he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, well, how can he take care of God's church?" Verse 6, "An overseer, an elder, must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment of the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders, so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap." We'll stop right there. These are qualities that churches should seek in their leadership. Friends, a church may not measure up to its leadership any more than Israel measured up to the spiritual stature of Moses during its wilderness wanderings over a period of 40 years. However, a church will never rise any higher collectively than its leaders. For as Jesus himself said, a disciple will not be greater than his teacher. And so it's imperative for the growth and health of a local church that it has solid leadership that sets a godly standard. In these days, finding that kind of pastor and those kinds of elders is not the slam dunk, maybe, that it used to be. And if it is harder than ever, and it is, I think, to find saintly pastors whose very lives call those whom they shepherd up to a higher biblical standard of discipleship, it's even more challenging to find a consistent core of lay elders who stick out like mountain peaks from their peers in the pews as rocks of Christian integrity and maturity. Unfortunately, folks, that's just the pathetic state of the average American church. On every hand, thank God for some exceptions, it's a soft, mellow, feel-good Christianity light. It's a form of Christianity that asks little, gives less, and demands nothing in the name of Christ. What we have so regularly out there today, in the way of churches, is a have-it-your-way version of culturally warped Christianity that the apostles would hardly recognize. In the early church, the apostles, like Paul, understood that qualified Christian leadership is a crucial building block in the mission of the local church. I tell you, folks, if a church is messed up there, it has no chance of being a chosen instrument of the Spirit of God. In this passage that I just read, Paul advises his protege Timothy about the kind of characteristics to look for in church leaders. You see, like fish, churches rot from the top. Now, before we get into the details of 1 Timothy chapter 3, allow me to make some preliminary observations. These, I hope, will allow us to understand these specific guidelines in context and apply them less mechanically than is sometimes done. First of all, I need to explain something about New Testament elders that gets very little mention, but it really needs to be better understood. This thing of church polity, the word refers to the organization of a local church, polity. This can be a very fractious and contentious thing. And over the years, I've heard people go round and round about congregational government, elder government, and so forth. We make a lot of things harder than they need to be. I said earlier, and I repeat now, three terms are synonymous in New Testament usage. This is not regularly recognized as it ought to be. Elders, which tends to refer to the maturity age-wise of church leaders. Shepherds refers to the guarding and guiding and feeding of the flock. We get our word pastors from the word shepherd. In Greek, a shepherd was a poimen, comes over in Latin as a pastor, and that's how it comes down to us. The pastor of your local church is a shepherd. And then there are bishops in the early church. These are overseers, comes from a word which means to look over. And this refers to their superintending work, to their monitoring work. So it looks at the work of what we would call a pastor from three different points of view. You will find these terms all used of the same persons in one passage, Acts chapter 20, verses 17 through 28. En route to Jerusalem, the Apostle Paul stopped over briefly at Miletus, near the coast of Asia Minor. From Miletus, he summoned the elders of the church in Ephesus for some final words as he made his way to Jerusalem. I want you to notice the equivalency. He used all three of those terms of the same people. Now that parity or equality in terminology becomes all the more significant once we realize that a shepherd in the Greek language means pastor in Latin and in English. They're the same thing. And an overseer just looks at the work, I say once again, from a superintending point of view. Now this is not merely an academic issue. You see, folks, when it comes to the matter of church government, it's helpful to appreciate that in the primitive New Testament church, there was functional equivalency between these three terms office-wise. Let me give you a concrete example of what can happen when people, and there are lots of them, they're not bad people, but I think there are people who are sometimes unsophisticated and do not understand. But when people trying to replicate, reproduce New Testament church polity, when they fail to see the point that I'm making. For some reason, some of my closest colleagues and student friends over the years, and I'm speaking particularly in my academic years, 21 years total, have been those of the Plymouth Brethren persuasion. A lot of good men, to that sect, ordained pastors are anathema. They say that the New Testament church had only a plurality of lay elders. Therefore, they conclude our churches should take our cues from that polity, and churches should have nothing other than lay elders. You should not have what we call traditionally pastors. Now, I believe they are mistaken on several grounds, but I'm confining myself to this one for the present. These sincere folk, in my judgment, fail to grasp this point I'm making about different words that just express from different angles the same work or the same office. The practical impact is that they labor valiantly on the margins. They fail to appreciate that New Testament elders, at least many of them, were not laymen in the traditional sense, but they were men fully devoted to the work, for example, the apostles like Peter, and they were supported by the churches. And those New Testament elders, they functioned like pastors, as we've known them down through the ages. But missing that fact, or perhaps just denying it, these good folk deny themselves, and this is the practical problem, they deny themselves the fully functioning, full-time pastors or elders to lead their assemblies, as they like to call them. And the practical upshot of that is that typically their chapels or assemblies are very small and almost invisible. Their polity or their system of church government forces their called men into, and that's where I've met most of them, into academia, where they can devote themselves to the ministry full-time and be supported financially. Now, let me say this. Ecclesiology, that has to do with the study of the church, it's an area of theology. Faulty ecclesiology is not a capital offense in heaven. But the further we get away from the wise precedents of the Word of God, insofar as those precedents are prescribed, not just described, the more it will have a weakening or deleterious effect on our ministry practice. That's why I'm bothering to make such a point of it by way of example. But bear in mind, folks, this, and if you're just tuning in, we're at the front of 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. We haven't gotten into the text. We've read it. What I'm saying is by way of introduction. In the New Testament era, we sometimes forget there were no church buildings for believers to meet in. So what? Somebody will say. Well, follow me here. As conversion skyrocketed, where do you think believers met? Well, early on in Jerusalem and in Judea, the first Jewish Christians probably tried to meet in their synagogues. Eventually, hostility drove them elsewhere. As the gospel moved outward and converts increased, we know for certain from New Testament allusions, I'll mention three, Romans 16, Colossians 4, and 1 Corinthians 16, we know from certain allusions that many house churches were established in the great metropolitan areas like Corinth, Ephesus, and Rome, for this is mentioned specifically. So what? Follow me. What that phenomenon tells us is that the church at Corinth, for example, consisted of a number of house churches. And where there was a house church, there had to be a leader, a pastor, or elder, or overseer. Terms meaning the same thing. You could look at him from three points of view. And that shepherd would have been what today is the functional equivalent of what we call a pastor, where the local units in a given city had the advantage of perhaps a larger venue. The numbers possibly were such that maybe in some cases there was more than one elder or pastor in that local body. Maybe it was a big house. That leadership arrangement would be somewhat on the model of a multi-staff church today. But about the multiple house church model, there can be no doubt. What's that mean? It means that the church at Corinth, or the church at Ephesus, or the church at Rome, was really the sum total of all the house churches there. See, when we think of the church of Corinth, don't we think there were thousands of believers in those cities? But somehow mentally, we just think of one people gathered in one place, and their elders being all of those leaders in that one church. But that is all wrong. There were house churches, and the elders at Ephesus, or the elders at Corinth, or the elders at Rome, were the pastors, the college of pastors of those house churches. And I would infer from that paradigm that the elders of any given church were then the council of pastors of that city, unless it was a small town or village where there was only one house church. In a city like Jerusalem, where again we know from the book of Acts, thousands early on came to Christ, it's impossible to imagine a scenario where all the local parties to the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, where they all attended Sunday services in one venue. Clearly, there must have been numerous local bodies meeting there in Jerusalem. They perhaps convened in various synagogues, or perhaps in other sites around the city. As I say, hostility, enmity had driven them out of the synagogues. Wherever they met, each met with its own pastor, or possibly pastors, depending on the size of that particular local body. As the early church matured organizationally, it is apparent that eventually things so evolved, and the organization of the local church did evolve. It is apparent that some one pastor or elder held in great esteem by others in that area, let's say, like James in Jerusalem, they became recognized as the de facto leader or lead elder or overseer or bishop. We know this to be the case from the post-apostolic records, the records immediately after all the apostles had passed off the scenes. They're preserved for us. In no time flat, once all the apostles had died off, or maybe even before a little bit, these gifted leaders, like Irenaeus, like Polycarp, came to be called a bishop or overseer. They were first among equals. They had great stature, and this term overseer differentiated them from ordinary elders or shepherds or pastors. They were more or less superintendents of the other pastors, and that was a natural evolution once the apostles had passed off the scene. So, you see, this whole notion of purely lay leaders was not the norm. I'm not saying that it is wrong or unbiblical. No, there's a difference between something being unbiblical, that is, against biblical prescription, and something being simply abiblical. That is, it's not presented that way prescriptively in the Bible. It's just different. I personally would prefer another name for this office to avoid confusion with the biblical one. One can, I think, make the case for such a layer of leader interposed between pastors and the rank and file membership of a local church. How can that be okay? Well, friends, we must differentiate, as I suggested earlier, between what the New Testament simply describes and what the authors mean to timelessly prescribe. There is a difference. For example, observe in Acts chapter 6, when the church was in its infancy, the apostles suddenly had a crisis. They felt the need to adapt to changing circumstances, polity-wise. So what did they do? Oops, they just jumped up and created, under the leadership of the Holy Spirit, an office of deacon to meet a heretofore unanticipated need. There is a lesson there in adaptation. So, in my view, while we should be very slow and circumspect in departing from New Testament practice in terms of church polity, I personally believe we must recognize the validity of this distinction that I've made a couple of times in this preamble, a distinction between what is descriptive, what is merely described in the New Testament writings, and what is intended to be prescriptive, that is, to tell us what we did here you should do for all time. We need to make sure that we do not legalistically impose upon the future church a polity of the early church, which was never intended to be timeless or one-size-fits-all prescription, and many fall into that fallacy. That said, I would make another important preliminary point before looking at this text in 1 Timothy chapter 3 regarding the qualification of elders. Whatever may be said about the historical organizational structure of the early church and non-binding features, the latter, non-binding features, does not apply to the qualification of elders, that is, pastors or overseers. For the need for these kinds of men to lead a local church is timeless. There's never been a time, there's never been a place, a situation, or a culture where less than this is really better. So these qualifications that we're going to meet here in 1 Timothy chapter 3 are prescriptive, and therefore they're not negotiable in their central principles. However, we must bear in mind that these qualifications relate to pastoral elders first and foremost. Paul did not have lay elders per se in mind. Yet, inasmuch as we have them, lay elders, and there's nothing wrong with having them, the more nearly they stack up to these standards of pastoral elders, well, obviously, the better. So why do I stress this point? It's this, that while it's imperative that pastors of a church fill the suit of these qualifications, I do not think the same rigorous standards necessarily apply to that class of church officers that we traditionally, but wrongly, describe as church elders. And why do I lower the bar for them a little, lay elders? Well, if we don't understand this, we are at risk, for the sake of functionality in the church, of having to blatantly ignore the application of God's standards, or at risk of shutting our eyes, being hypocritical, and just pretending that we're matching elders to biblical qualifications when actually we're really looking the other way. In the average church today, maybe any day, unless an elder board is limited to two or three men, you're not going to scare up a great many guys who fill the suit on all four corners. I'm talking about lay elders. So let's not be hypocritical here. Finally, an important point about ticky-tacky mechanical application of these elder credentials. Over the years, I have noticed that in evaluation of elder candidates, I'm talking about lay elders, some folk have a tendency to use this catalog of qualification as a kind of microscope. In doing so, approaching this atomistically, they disqualify good, credible laymen right and left. That's because under the unforgiving, all-telling eye of that speck-revealing microscope, they will detect some blemish not at all evident to the normal eye. And in this mode of evaluation, they miss the apostle's point, namely the big picture. They miss the spirit of it. A nitpicking, legalistic measure narrows the candidates down to a pool so small that one could hardly ever fill the pulpits of our churches, much less a lay elder board, with perfect fits. We should note that this list of qualifications, then, is informal. It's a bit off the cuff. It varies in some particulars from the one in Titus. That is telling. So it's about vetting out those with leprosy, not people with a few pimples. I'll explain myself more fully in our next study. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.